My name is Daisha Clay. I'm the audio librarian here at Classical 91.7. While I'm a real librarian, I have a deep, dark
secret.
I know very little about classical music. I grew up listening to rock, and I know something about jazz. But when it comes to classical, but I really want to learn. So, every week on this show, a classical music expert will give me a piece of classical music they think I should know, and then we'll discuss it. Come learn with me in the classical classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Daisha Clay, and here with me today is King Goldsmith, who is professor of violin at Rice University's Shepherd School of Music. He is a chamber musician and a soloist. His former violin students can be found in major orchestras and string quartets all over the place, including the Houston Symphony, the Metropolitan Opera, and the Enzo String Quartet. He has recorded on pretty much all of the major classical labels, and he's a Grammy nominee. Ken, welcome to the Classical Classroom.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
What are you going to be teaching me about today?
We're going to talk about three different composers, and the work that we're going to discuss with each composer deals with daybreak.
Daybreak.
Morning.
Why morning?
Well, it's a wonderful way to discuss the aesthetic and the period and the reasons of each of these composers and why they wrote this way.
Okay.
So I think it basically deals with creativity. Uh-huh. Each of these composers has the two prerequisites to be creative. Number one, curiosity.
Yeah.
It's the first thing. Number two, imagination is the second thing. And without either of those, you can't be creative.
Mm-hmm.
You can be curious about things, but it doesn't mean you're going to create something important.
Right.
And if you use your imagination applied to whatever it is you're curious about, then you can start to think about various other things. So we're going to deal with three musical periods. The classical period, represented by Joseph Haydn.
Mm-hmm.
The nationalistic and romantic period of Edvard Grieg.
Uh-huh.
And the impressionistic period of Maurice Ravel.
Okay.
Who incidentally was in Houston in 1928 and addressed the audience at Rice University on the state of music in the world.
That was when he was here. And people think he may have been working on Bolero.
He
is
was.
Is that right?
That's right.
I did learn something.
I'm so glad.
Okay, so I feel like curiosity and imagination are something that are kind of natural to pretty much everybody.
They are.
So I'm over the course of this discussion, I'm going to be kind of paying attention to what it is that makes these guys different, what makes them stand out from Joe Schmo. You know,
well,
what
let's
makes
start,
him special?
Let's start with Joe Haydn.
Okay.
So Joseph Haydn, who was born before Handel and Bach died, so at the end of the Baroque era, and then was living while Beethoven became popular.
Mm-hmm.
So he's into the Romantic already. So he was kind of our creator of the symphony and the string quartet.
Uh-huh.
Symphonic works were really based on Concerto Grosso of Bach.
And
Vivaldi. So those early concertos where everybody seems to be playing all the time and it's based on dance music, those kinds of things.
Okay.
Think of Vivaldi Seasons.
Uh-huh.
Haydn was appointed in 1761 to be the head of the music staff of Prince Nicholas Esterhazy, who was one of the most wealthy men in Europe and had castled all over the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which later became the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
Yeah.
And Esterhazy was an amateur musician. And he had a staff of 70 musicians.
Mm-hmm.
He took over a hunting lodge, built quarters for them, so they all lived together. They all had a communal dining room and chef, their own uniforms. He took care of their instruments.
Wow.
Everything. I mean, it was an ideal gig.
Man.
So Haydn had his own orchestra for 35 years.
They liked their musicians back then.
Absolutely. They loved it. And, well, especially he did.
Yeah.
And they were just considered very marvelous members of the household.
Huh.
So at this time, when Haydn was just starting with the symphonies and a new employer, he decided, how can I impress him? I know he loves living in the country rather than in his castles in the city. He loves the country of Eisenstadt especially.
Uh-huh.
And mountains and countryside. And what we have to remember in 1761 is there was no electricity.
Yeah.
So the day started with daylight.
Yeah.
And you can imagine being in a wooden bed with probably a mattress stuffed with down, and you go to bed when it gets dark, and you get up when it gets light.
Uh-huh.
And so Haydn decided he would write three symphonies, Daybreak, Noon, and Evening, uh-huh. for the prince, uh-huh. and show how skilled he was at this wonderful orchestra that he had suddenly inherited using all of these people,
yeah.
and how he could depict everyday life in a very vivid way. So this is the opening of the first symphony number 6, his first in this series of three symphonies. And because he's a classical composer and he has a classical style orchestra of strings, pairs of winds, and horns, he used all of them in a very virtuoso manner. But this is extremely calm. And if you consider that Haydn, at the beginning of a day, is looking at the beginning of his harmony, mm-hmm. he builds a simple rhythm on an arpeggio, just a chord.
Okay.
So we have D, and then F sharp, and A, and as it rises and gets more, I won't say strong, it doesn't really get strong, but as it rises and becomes fuller, and the winds come in and complete the chord, you have the impression of land with dawn breaking over it.
Okay.
And then we know we're awake because we hear the flute sound like the rooster.
All right, let's hear this thing. Is a great alarm clock. Totally going to program this into my alarm clock.
It's perfect.
It's nice.
Yeah.
It's that's like such a lovely depiction of the sun coming up. Really. So Haydn, he had a pretty idyllic sounding life. He's basically getting to live in a castle with a bunch of musicians.
Every day.
For years.
And not just orchestra, but chamber music every day.
Every
His
day.
His prince played the baritone, which is like a cello.
Uh-huh.
He wrote 146 baritone trios for him.
Yeah.
And Haydn wrote an enormous 104 symphonies, you know, tremendous number of string quartets, operas, everything. See, huge. Amount of work. But he could do that because there he was.
Yeah, exactly.
He was supported his whole life.
That's what I was going to say, is that, like, he's in, I mean, you kind of couldn't ask for more perfect circumstances to be curious and imaginative and to therefore create. I mean, he's, like, I also kind of love the fact that the prince was like, well, record players haven't been invented yet, so I'm just going to bring the music to me.
Absolutely.
The
and every holiday, he would invite dukes and princes from all over the area to come to celebrate the holidays.
That's the coolest.
Knowing that this was the Esterházy Orchestra, was a great orchestra.
Wow.
And generations of players.
Wow. This was like a social experiment, sort of.
In a way, it was done on smaller scales in the Baroque, which princes supported, but mostly churches supported groups. Vivaldi was supported by his girls' school and things like that. He mm-hmm. was in residence there. But it left them free to write and play.
Yeah.
Which was the whole idea.
Man.
We're lucky that we had, Haydn had Esterházy, that we have this incredible body of music.
Yeah.
And there's this little sidebar that might interest you. I've looked at many Haydn manuscripts, and there are very few instructions in the manuscripts.
Mm-hmm.
And when I looked at Mozart manuscripts, there's something on almost every single note. And I began to get curious, why did Mozart write something on every note and Haydn hardly wrote anything?
Yeah.
And it occurred to me, oh my goodness, Haydn didn't tour. He had his own orchestra. And when a new person came into the orchestra, someone would say, Haydn liked this note short. Haydn liked that note long. He didn't have to write anything, and Mozart never had his own orchestra.
He was right there.
He was a touring virtuoso with his own music. So he took all of his stuff everywhere he went and put the music on the stands, and they saw, oh, this note's short, this note's lifted. This is all of this stuff was there because usually he didn't have a rehearsal. And he was a wonderful patriarch for his musicians. He stood up for them. He worked for them. He used them in a virtuoso manner, knowing that they would get extra pay if they did that kind of thing.
Nice.
So let's move on to another era.
All right.
Edvard Grieg.
Okay.
One of the Romantics' most beloved composers, Norwegian composer, grew up in that gorgeous, gorgeous country. And we're going to hear the Morning Mood from the Peer Gynt Suite. Mm-hmm. Peer Gynt is a play written by Henrik Ibsen. One of the great plays because it defined the Norwegian character. It was like a list of fables. The suites are taken out of the incidental music that Ibsen asked Grieg to write for the production.
Yeah.
In those days, and rarely now, but when plays were done, they had instrumental music. Sibelius wrote incidental music to The Tempest of Shakespeare years later. So this suite is very famous. People know all of these movements. Mm-hmm. And his Morning Mood is one of the favorites, but this has a kick to it because in the incidental music, this Morning Mood, which sounds as a most magnificent sunrise over the fjord and the mountains, is written when Peer Gynt was shipwrecked on the coast of Morocco in the desert.
What?
Yes. So he's actually dreaming about Norway.
Oh,
and
okay.
Wakes up and is immediately chased in palm trees by an ape. So it's hysterical. And a lot of people have thought this was written to depict the desert. But that's because they don't know the play. So he's dreaming. And what you will hear is a very simple shepherd's flute song.
Okay.
And the sun comes up, of course, in the east, which is behind the mountains.
Yeah.
So the first thing to be lit are the mountain tops. And then you will hear the shadows of the mountains moving across the lower parts. And it's absolutely stunning as the orchestra goes from a very small group of players to a huge romantic orchestra.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So this is full-blown romantic music.
All right.
Morning Mood of Grieg. And the shepherds talk one to the other. It's starting to get light. And we can see. Few shadows move here in the lower instruments. First level of light in the beginning of dawn. You can almost see the sun going down the sides of the mountains. Thank you.
Tell me again when this piece was written.
The premiere, it was written in 1875.
Okay, so we've made a jump of nearly 200 years here.
100.
100. 100.
Mm-hmm, a century.
Okay, a century. Mm-hmm. The instrumentation is so different.
Different. It's so filled different. Out a rich orchestra.
Yeah. We've got brass, we've got flutes, we've got like the strings.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a French horn in there?
Oh, yes. Four of them.
Okay, so Haydn, he's in this environment that essentially could not foster creativity more. I mean, it's basically just this perfect little petri dish of creative energy that's going on. And he produces like crazy. Now, what about Grieg? Like, what were his circumstances?
That's a very good thing that you suggested, because Haydn was asked later in life why he wasn't influenced by any other composers. And he said, because I was isolated for all of these years, and I had to create my own world.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
Grieg was in Europe, where there was lots of travel already, lots of kinds of nationalistic music from other countries.
Mm-hmm.
He became popular in large part because of Johannes Brahms. Brahms heard his music when Grieg applied for a government grant for publication.
Mm-hmm.
And he did the same thing for other composers. He especially liked Grieg. He introduced him to his publisher, and not only that, but proofread his manuscripts when they were submitted for publication.
Wow.
So one of the greatest composers in Europe took Grieg under his wing.
Nice. That helps.
Yeah, it helps a lot. So Grieg's music is extremely recognizable because of its nationalistic trends. He used folk songs. All of the music of Peer Gynt has Hardanger fiddles in it, orchestras of violins that are folk violins with 6 to 8 strings and sympathetic strings, and is just great country music for Norway.
Interesting. And did was he, I mean, well-to-do financially?
He was supported by the government as well as royalties of his concerts, and everybody, his music was very popular.
Okay. I'm always interested in that because, you know, there's plenty of great music that is born out of really terrible life circumstances, but like Auden, the writer, he said, he talks a little bit about how really most creative works kind of come from people who are wealthy because, frankly, they have time to create things.
Mm-hmm.
And people who are poorer are usually out, you know, doing grunt work. And when they get home at the end of the day, they're too tired to sit down and write a symphony,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I always think about that when I'm thinking about these composers. I wonder what their lives were like. So that's interesting that he was also sort of kind of cared for.
He was. The Scandinavian countries cared very much for their artists, their playwrights, their writers, and they supported them. Much the way that Japan has national artists.
Yeah.
Amsterdam does the same thing. Holland supports their arts and their artists so that they are free to work.
That's such a lovely, lovely thing. We should do that more here.
Yes. Yes, we should.
All right. So Ravel. Ravel is our next.
All right. Famous French composer, impressionistic composer, Ravel and Debussy.
Yeah.
But the subject matter of the impressionist wasn't day to day. It went back to the Greeks and Romans. They were very interested in the modes. They were interested in the restoration of all of these antiquities. And they were interested in the plays and the stories told on pottery and the stories of shepherds and shepherdesses. And so that's why the Impressionists dealt so much with those ancient Greek plays.
Mm-hmm.
Because of that, they could invent their own exoticism. Uh-huh. Exoticism was a big thing for them.
Yeah.
And so he fell in love with the fable of Daphnis and Chloe, a shepherd and a shepherdess, which takes place on the island of Lesbos. And the island of Lesbos is almost in Turkey. And when we think of the Greek Isles today, we don't imagine what they were like 2,000 years ago, mm-hmm. which had tigers and lions on them even then, and forests. And even with Haydn's music, we go to Austria-Hungary today, we don't realize what it was like in 1700.
Uh-huh.
Have you ever read the book A World Lit Only by Fire?
No.
By Manchester, uh-huh. William Manchester? It's a view of the medieval and just the beginning of the Renaissance, a very readable history of things that we don't think about from 500 to 1400.
Uh-huh.
Where in the years of 800, let's say, a squirrel could go from what is now Russia all the way to the Atlantic Ocean and never touch the ground. The forest was so thick.
Whoa!
Or
to be a squirrel then.
Yeah. Right. So Diaghilev and the Russian Ballet commissioned Ravel to write the music for this.
Uh-huh.
And so he invented his forest on the island of Lesbos and this whole drama, which is it's a two-hour-long ballet. It's his longest work.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't any pictures of Lesbos in, let's say, the time of Christ. They don't exist.
Yeah.
But I think the closest, I've seen some drawings, is Pandora in Avatar.
Oh, yes.
If you can think of what Pandora, the levels of what the forest was like.
Oh.
So this is an enormous orchestra. And Levée du Jour, the opening of day mm-hmm. of this, takes place on the forest floor. And it is a forest that is comparable only to the redwood forests, if you've ever been. There's almost
yes.
no light.
Ugh.
And you'll hear little rivulets of water. It's the first thing. If you open your eyes in the forest, or close them and open them, you hear water. And then you begin to hear insects. And because this is a fable, you'll start to hear pan flutes. And you know that it's peopled by fauns and unicorns and unusual animals. But it's based, as Haydn is, on this simple triad. He uses a fourth and a fifth. So the bass, the whole way through, goes dee-dom, ba-da-dee-dom, ba-dum, up a fourth, down a fifth. And that gradually gets wider and wider and wider until it envelops the whole forest.
Mm-hmm.
And you have many levels of light arriving.
Yeah.
So we should hear this.
Okay, let's.
The water is a constant. Insects and birds.
How many harps is that?
At least two, maybe more.
Wow.
Birds? Also celeste? So you've gone from the forest floor, but you can sort of see
uh-huh.
the tops of the trees.
Yeah.
And now you begin to notice things that are around you. Slow-moving animals. And the shepherd wakes up, Daphnis. And plays. There he is. On stage, the animals gravitate toward him. He stretches. Meanwhile, it's gradually getting lighter. The whole pitch goes up now. A much wider range. And the violins. The winds wake up. The forest nymphs.
There are people in there.
There are nymphs. Yes. Denizens of the forest. Some half animal, half human. First rays of the sun. Animals start to run and move. Now the shepherdess comes onto the scene when everything is very still. And she is enhanced by the complete break of day. Goes from the bottom all the way to the top. Everybody notices her. Percussion.
Wow, Ravel.
It's phenomenal.
That is...
And to play it is phenomenal.
That is so much fun. That's just... It's lovely, but it strikes me that he had this... I mean, such a romantic vision of what this... Clearly, this mythological world was like.
Mm-hmm.
There are no predator... I mean, the first thing I think about, you know, sleeping in the woods would be that bugs would be coming after me and there would be predators, and this is just like, there's nothing like that.
No.
It's just...
But they were there.
Yeah. But I like that Ravel's imagination.
Oh, it's extraordinary. You look at the plates and the cups and things from that period mm-hmm. that they had all in the island of Crete. All of that stuff's on there. The lion hunts, yeah. the bear hunts, all of those. It's awesome to think 2,000 years ago there were bears on those islands and lions yeah. on those islands. It's amazing.
Tell me again when Ravel wrote this piece.
1909, he got okay. the commission. It was okay. premiered in 1912.
Okay.
And 12-tone music was being... 1913 was The Rite of Spring of Stravinsky.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Which is also impressionistic.
Yeah, I love that piece. I'll ask the same question that I asked about Grieg. What were Ravel's sort of life circumstances?
He struggled.
Was he also a kept man? He struggled.
He struggled.
Okay, now tell me about that.
He made his money from playing the piano and from writing music.
Okay, so he was literally living from
a living composer.
Commission.
That's right.
Huh? How does that show up in his music? Does it?
In the small amount of work that he did,
yeah,
he was limited in how much time he had to do that.
Okay,
but he was also supported by his friends like Debussy, and it was a mutual admiration society.
Uh-huh.
When people thought his string quartet was a little strange, and Debussy said, "Don't change one note."
Nice.
Thank goodness he didn't. But he wrote a piano trio, but he played his music too. So he was He earned money from being a professional pianist and touring, and he was a teacher as well.
So he was, but he was friends. He was sort of, in his own way, surrounded by creative people.
Satie and Mio and all these wonderful impressionistic composers and early romantic composers that from that period, from the 20th century.
I think that it's interesting that you kind of presented this as a formula, that curiosity plus imagination equals creativity. Because I think that curiosity, that's a real key.
Absolutely.
Like, I mean, everybody has imagination. And everybody to a degree is curious. But I think a lot of us walk around in our daily lives kind of choosing not to notice people because notice things that are going on around us because we're quite busy. And I think maybe creative people give a bit more time to that curiosity. They allow that curiosity to sort of flourish a bit more in themselves.
I try to teach that. I make my students, when they learn a piece, they say, what can you tell me from the score about this piece? And that means you have to look at when it was written, who wrote it, what's in the score. I mean, he puts a lot of stuff in the score there. And you need to think about the meanings of those words. Forte does not mean loud. Forte means strong. Uh-huh. You go to Naples and order a cafe forte, they aren't going to bring you a loud coffee. They're going to bring you a strong coffee. Piano means calm. All of they didn't think in English.
Yeah.
These have different meanings. And so they have to learn to be curious about what the composer put on a piece of paper. It's a map.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting, too, that these composers, it's been kind of a tour of societal circumstances that they lived under, how those things come out in the music.
We have a lot of people today who have a lot of money and try to become composers, but they don't have either the curiosity, the creative bent, or the chops. They don't make it. Wealth can be just the opposite.
Yeah.
You don't have to go through that process.
The
you do have to
struggle.
Go through that process. I think today, though, a lot of people reach a level and they're happy with it.
Yeah.
Sting spent 2 years learning to play the lute so that he could do Elizabethan madrigals and songs. The Beatles listened to Bartok string quartets, and you find it in Eleanor Rigby. They used all of that stuff. They never stopped learning.
Yeah.
So there are those, Taylor Swift, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know about people like Taylor Swift. I mean, I think it's hard to dismiss them out of hand because there are so many people who get something emotional out of that music, you know? I feel like that creativity is coming from a different place. I honestly don't know how much Taylor Swift puts into her own music or if her music is written by a team and then, you know, essentially crafted in, you know, test tubes and
without electronics. Without electronics, she would have to exist on what she produces in a concert.
Uh-huh.
This is the Ken Goldsmith's theory of how to resurrect music, is no electronic reproduction of music for 5 years, nothing broadcast over the airways. You want to hear something, you go to a concert.
Oh, I like this.
So all performers get paid the same thing.
Yeah.
It would change the face of music.
This
the way
is
it used
wonderful.
To be.
It's basically like hitting the reset button.
Yes, it
I
is.
I like that.
Good.
Okay, you people, you heard it. No, get cracking on this. Tear down the iTunes. Wait, no, do not tear down iTunes because that's how you hear Classical Classroom. I take it back. Well, Ken Goldsmith, it has been a pleasure to meet you and to talk about this great music today.
Thank you. Nice to meet you, Tasha.
All right, everybody, that about does it for this episode of Classical Classroom. Did you know that you can now listen to Classical Classroom not only on iTunes, not only on SoundCloud, but on Stitcher Radio and on TuneIn? Wait. Todd, you came into my office while I was in the middle of writing that sentence, and I didn't finish it. You can also connect with us on Twitter and Tumblr. True story. Go to HoustonPublicMedia.org/classroom to find links to all of these and more. You can send me an email at dclay@HoustonPublicMedia.org or follow me on Twitter. I'm CC Dacia. Thanks to audio producer Todd Tetherball King Holslander for making us sound nice today. Thanks to St. John Flynn for almost buying me lunch that one time. Thanks to Ken Goldsmith for being here today. Thanks to me for saying words. But mostly, of course, thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time.